the Total Soccer Show and our look back over the international break. Yes, we brought you all the USMNT coverage and now we're looking at the Euro 2024 playoffs, some of the big talking points from the biggest friendlies and some of the big storylines that took place on the international stage. My name's Ryan Bailey, gruesome twosome today, joining me, Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ryan. How are you? Are you looking forward to talking about your favourite thing in the whole wide world, the international break? Not just any old international break, but an international break full of friendlies. Yeah. I know you're a big fan.
It's wonderful. It's been a wonderful couple of weeks, Graham. I've enjoyed it very much indeed. It's up there with Timo Werner on my list of soccer
players. Oh, right. Wow, as high as that. Not quite as high as Giorgio Chiellini, but as high as Timo Werner.
Woof. He's a different...
He's on a different scale altogether.
We don't joke about Chiellini, frankly, Graham.
I do.
We don't joke about that. but how have you felt about this international break? It's the last one of the European season, obviously, and the last big break before Euro 2024. We'll see a couple more friendlies from each Euro 2024 team before the tournament, but they'll be in June. So the last chance to see a lot of these teams in their tune-ups before the big tournament in Germany.
Yeah, personally for me, it wasn't a great international window by virtue of Scotland being really, really bad. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. I do understand why a lot of people don't like this window. Obviously, it feels like it kind of breaks up the final stretch of the domestic season, certainly in Europe. I do find it interesting in a sense, though, because it is the final opportunity, as you mentioned, Ryan, for experimentation before the Euros and the Copa America. But then friendlies are just so difficult to judge. I'm not sure it does teams a lot of good, especially the ones who end up creating negative headlines where I'm not sure they're entirely warranted. But there are things in each match that you can identify, have a look at, analyse, which is what we're going to do with a number of games. And then, of course, a number of playoffs in Europe that where teams punched their ticket to Germany, which was obviously very dramatic and interesting there as well.
They did indeed. Why don't we get to that, Graham? As you mentioned, the final three places of the European Championships have now been decided. All 24 teams are locked in. We had Path A, Path B and Path C deciding the three final teams. Brilliantly named they were. So in Path A, Graham, we have Poland going through after a heartbreaking night for the Welsh. 0-0 this one finished their final game. Poland winning 5-4 on penalties in a shootout in this one. This is after a semi-final of Path A where Poland beat Estonia and Wales beat Finland. So the Welsh, Graham, were going for a fourth consecutive major tournament here, which is, for them, unprecedented, and it would have been an incredible run, but heartbreak for them.
Look, I don't want to gloat when a team loses a penalty shootout to make a major tournament. I'll rephrase that. I do want to gloat, but I won't because that is not a good look. But obviously, this was heartbreak for Wales. I think the bigger regret for them, rather than the Dan James missed penalty, even me with my, at this point, I have to say, anti-Wales national team agenda, found that difficult to watch when a single player misses the penalty in the shootout to miss out on a place in a major tournament. That's just a difficult watch. But a bigger regret than that for Wales, I think, will be that they started qualification so slowly. I think that was due to Rob Page trying to figure out what this team should look like in a post-Gareth Bale age, and that took some time. Rob Page, I don't know if you remember this, Ryan, very nearly lost his job midway through qualifying. He was asked in a press conference about reports that the Welsh FA were looking to alternative candidates to replace him. Obviously, he didn't take that very well. But now you have this youthful-looking team that is building around players like Harry Wilson and Brennan Johnson. So in a weird way, I'd be more hopeful if I was a Welsh fan now than I was after the World Cup. Having said that, I hope they have fun watching the Euros from home because this has been me way too many times in the past. And yes, I am bitter about it.
Wow. Wow, yeah, you've let that show on your sleeve very much, Graham.
But I can't backtrack at this point. No. I've come too far.
from a neutral perspective, Graham, which team out of Poland or Wales would you have preferred to see at the tournament? I do think Wales might have had slightly more of an X factor. Maybe I'm thinking of Gareth Bale Wales, though, to be fair, when I think of recent tournament performances. But then again, Poland quarterfinals in 2016. I don't think they cleared the group stages and other Euros around that time. Haven't done great in the World Cup, I don't think, either. Oh, no, they got out of the group in the World Cup, didn't they, the last World Cup as well. So who do you think will have a sturdier chance out of these teams? Obviously, it's going to be Poland, but...
Yeah, given the fact that Wales are not going to be there. But when you ask the question, who would I most like to watch at the Euros? I'm going to actually see Poland at the Euros. I have a ticket for a France game in Dortmund, and it was one of the matches against one of these teams, and it's turned out to be Poland. So it was between Poland and Wales. I'm personally quite pleased that it's Poland. You talk about the X factor of Gareth Bale. We have to talk about the X factor of Robert Lewandowski, who's very much the icon of this team. Poland, in my mind, have just always been kind of tournament underachievers. I don't think in terms of individual talent, this is the strongest squad that they've had in the last decade or so, but there are obviously recognisable names in there. We talked about Jakub Kiwior on The Big Thing this week, or we're going to talk about him tomorrow. But yeah, Lewandowski is still the difference maker for this team, as lazy a soundbite as that might be. If he turns up at the Euros, finds his shooting boots, then that could make a big difference.
Indeed. All right, shall we move on to path B, Graham? Ukraine coming to Euro 2024. Excellent achievement for them. Bear in mind, they're a country very much still at war. Yeah. They had a 2-1 win over Iceland in their final in Path B, in their home game. Staged in Poland, of course, not staged in Ukraine for the aforementioned reasons. To reach this game, Ukraine beat Bosnia and Iceland beat Israel to reach this stage. But yeah, Ukraine once again back on the European stage.
And an incredible achievement by them for obvious reasons. I wrote about Ukrainian football for the newsletter last week and how the national team is, as you mentioned, Ryan, having to play every single match away from home. The playoff final against Iceland was played in Poland, as you say, and that was meant to be their home game. Keep in mind that Ukraine were one bad refereeing decision in the final qualifier against Italy from qualifying automatically. They were in a very difficult group with England and Italy. I think they miss out on qualifying on goal difference. It was certainly very tight, and the last game is away to Italy. Mudryk goes down in the penalty box. It's a clear penalty for whatever reason. The referee doesn't give it, and then UEFA admit it was a mistake afterwards, which I'm sure was consolation to Ukraine, who had to take their chances in the playoff. But this is a solid team that they've got. Mudryk, he's a different player for Ukraine than he is for Chelsea. I've watched him a couple times. He makes much better use of his pace. He's incisive for Ukraine. They look to him with possession much more often than Chelsea do. Dobvik is the focal point, of course, having a great season in La Liga. Zinchenko is another player who's just completely different for his national team. He plays in central midfield. He's a creator. He's a deep-lying playmaker. He's very good at that role as well. So, yeah, they are a good team. I expect they could make an impact at Euro 2024. And even if they don't, their mere qualification, given the circumstances, is one of the stories of that tournament.
It definitely is, Graham. And of course, conceding they have had very difficult circumstances and they continue to do so, would you have expected them to need the qualification path, this qualification path, to get in? Because you mentioned it was very tight to qualify in the first place, but like, they're a really good caliber team. Like Euro 2020, they got to the quarterfinals. England, of course, ending that run in that tournament. But they're a good tournament team. I was expecting them not to need this path necessarily.
Well, they, as I say, they landed in a very difficult group. So you would say they are probably the third best in the group of England, Italy, and then Ukraine. And then even in kind of recent qualification campaigns, so they failed to qualify for the last World Cup. They were beaten by Wales in the playoff final. I remember that because Ukraine beat Scotland at Hampden in the playoff semi-final. And then even in the Nations League after that, which counts towards what pot you're in, Scotland finished ahead of Ukraine in that group. So they have maybe underachieved in their last couple of campaigns, which results in what pot they're in, which ended up in them being in a group with England and Italy. So there's a knock-on effect there, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, and the third team to qualify for Euro 2024 in the past week, Georgia, European nation rather than the state in the southeast of the US. For the first time ever, Graham, in a major final competition. We had some lovely scenes, fans running onto the field in jubilation when they got a 4-2 penalty shootout win over Greece after a 0-0 final score in that one. But yeah, well done to Georgia.
Yeah, had Georgia not qualified, this would have been the first European Championships on record without a debutant nation. As it is, the streak continues. Georgia will be at the Euros for the first time ever. This is their first ever major tournament as a whole. They've never been to a World Cup either. I'm frankly very surprised that Georgia managed to make it through the playoffs because they were in Scotland's group. I watched them a number of times. Wasn't really impressed. They finished fourth in a five-team group. Coming into qualification, I thought there was a chance they would be dangerous. Willy Sanyol, the former Bayern Munich player, is their manager. He'd done a decent job coming into this campaign of building around Kvaradona as their star player. He made them difficult to beat. But that kind of it kind of disintegrated in the campaign itself, but reappeared then in the playoffs where they kept clean sheets against Luxembourg and then against Greece. Greece had quite a strong qualification campaign. They'll feel a little bit sore that they haven't come through this with a Euros place. They probably thought of the draw against Luxembourg and then or against Georgia in the final as quite favourable. But yeah, as I say, Georgia very difficult to beat. That has been the main success of Sanyol's time in charge. I think they could be awkward opponents at the Euros if they can stay compact at the back. And then they have Kvaradona as an attacking difference maker. International football, the margins are slim in that regard. So as I say, if they're tight at the back and then have a player of that calibre to make the difference in the final third, yeah, they might be challenging opponents.
Yeah, so Georgia, Graham, they're in Group F. They're joined by Turkey, Portugal and the Czech Republic. I could see, you know, potentially this is a group where the top three could go through. I can see it happening, right?
Yeah, I mean that is a good group to drop into. Remind me of again Turkey, Portugal, and who's the third team?
Czech Republic.
Yeah, so Turkey got smashed, I think 6-1 by Austria in this window. So they had a very good campaign, but maybe in a very Scotland reminiscent way, heading into the tournament on a bit of a low ebb. So absolutely, I think getting out that group is a realistic prospect for Georgia.
Yeah, just to run through the other groups that the other teams who have qualified are in. Poland are in with the Netherlands, Austria and France. A slightly more challenging group for them, I'd suggest. But once again, a top two advance to the knockout stage, and there's possible, based on ranking, third teams going through. So you do never know if Poland pick up a point or two. So could happen, I guess, but harder path for them, one would suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. We might talk a little bit later on about Austria, or I'll mention them because they did something incredible in this international window, but they're strong under Ralf Rangnick. I think they've won their last six games. They haven't lost since November 2022, I think. So when you factor in an in-form Austria team and then the Netherlands and France, yeah, that's a tricky group for Poland to land in.
It is indeed. And just to talk about Ukraine's group, they're in Group E, Belgium, Slovakia and Romania. Doable, I suppose, right?
Well, I've got a ticket for the big match from that group, the one that everyone wanted, Slovakia-Romania in Frankfurt. Yeah, that's the headline marquee game from that one.
The Waldstadion, it tells me here on Wikipedia, Graham. Very good. Mind track.
If you say so.
That's going to be fun. Excellent stuff. All right, so those are the teams that have qualified for the Euros. Let's take a quick break, actually. When we come back, maybe we'll talk a bit more about the Euros and some of the big boys who are going to be going to Germany back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Total Soccer Show, we are reviewing the international break. Plenty of juicy friendlies, Graham, if there is such a thing, during this break. England with a couple of big games against Brazil and Belgium. Some interesting learnings here. Actually, I'll tell you what. We mentioned like this is like a potential test run for the Euros, which are in a couple of months' time. A concern of mine would be, like, Kobbie Mainoo looking really good for England in these games, in the defensive two with Declan Rice, you know. But is it wise, if you don't have to make a change at this stage when we've got two more friendlies and they're immediate tune-ups before the tournament? Is it too soon before a tournament to be making significant changes for any international team? It feels like that's why one of my reservations about this window in particular, because it's just a bit too close to make a wholesale change, if you will.
Yeah, I understand that point. But if I were to flip it, I would say this is the last opportunity to make those wholesale changes. If you're going to keep in mind, the last international break was in November, right? So that's quite a big portion of time that has passed. Players are out of form. Players are injured. Kobbie Mainoo. I mean, had Gareth Southgate even heard of Kobbie Mainoo back in November? Now he's a first team player for Manchester United. So I think this is the last opportunity, if you're going to make those wholesale changes, to do it, because by the time you get to June, that's way too close. You're calling up your squad. By the time you're playing those friendlies, I'd imagine it's at a preliminary squad, and then it's cut down to 23 or 26 players. Apparently it might be 26 players. I read that today, that Gareth Southgate's made the case to UEFA, and a lot of managers are on his side, so I have a feeling that might get passed through. But yeah, you can't be experimenting in June. The June games are just mainly about meeting up together as a team and getting some fitness in the legs, and this feels like the last opportunity for experimentation. If Kobbie Mainoo had broken through after this point for Manchester United, he wouldn't be in the squad for the Euros. So that's kind of how I would frame it.
Okay. Do you think he starts in the Euros then, Graham, based on that?
Yeah, I think so. So let me just set the table with England. On the face of things, not the best window for England. Lost to Brazil. That was a pretty insipid performance, to be honest. And then they needed a Bellingham stoppage time equaliser.
That game was the reason I don't like international breaks game. I sat through that thing. Thank you very
Brazil
much.
Brazil don't even have nice kits anymore. I don't know what's going on with their kits. But yeah, the Belgium performance wasn't much better. England's away kit, by the way, that I really like that one. They wore it against Belgium. And I like the Belgium one as well. I know you have differing opinions on that. To be honest, I don't know if reading too much into friendly performances is wise, especially given what this window is. A lot of these players are understandably in club modes. But there were three bullet points from England coming out of this window, and one of them was Kobbie Mainoo, who made his debut off the bench against Brazil, then started against Belgium, was very, very impressive, certainly against Belgium. This England lineup is pretty settled by and large. You can go through the team and you can pinpoint the key players, but that central position alongside Declan Rice is maybe the one position where there is a position up for grabs. At the last Euros, that player was Calvin Phillips. It's not going to be him this summer. At the World Cup, it was Jordan Henderson. It shouldn't be him this summer, although he's still in the squad. It might be him. Until recently, that player was probably Conor Gallagher.
Yeah.
Or the other option would have been to drop Bellingham deeper into midfield and then have Phil Foden as the number 10. But that doesn't really seem like a wise thing to do to me, given that Bellingham as a number 10 is potentially the best player in the world right now. But all of a sudden, Mainoo has burst through. And at this point, I would predict that he will start for England at the Euros because he is perfect for that role. He takes the ball in tight spaces. He is extremely press resistant. He can dribble. He can carry the ball. He sprays passes out from deep. One of the most striking things about him is just how comfortable he seems as an 18-year-old in this environment. He's taken it all in his stride. I remember we spoke about his first game for Manchester United. I think it was against Everton. And that was one of the most striking things, was he just went into that Manchester United team and he's one of the most composed, calm players on the pitch. He's done exactly the same thing for England. So there's no reason to believe that he can't carry that into the Euros, and he is the best option for that role in my mind at this point.
My concern, Graham, I agree with you. My concern is that Gareth Southgate wouldn't see it that way. He's quite a conservative manager. I think he might see him as a squad player at this point. And I'd be thinking he might be more inclined to go with like a Conor Gallagher kind of option. But also, one other thing. like Mainoo's like lots of positive play, like picking the forward pass rather than the sideways and the backwards one. I don't know if Gareth Southgate likes that, frankly. Or England, as a general thing, England doesn't like that kind of positivity from its players, it seems.
Here's my compromise prediction, right? Jordan Henderson starts that first match, doesn't do very well, but by the end of the tournament, that's Kobbie Mainoo alongside Declan Rice. How about that?
I was going to say I could live with that, but I'd rather not live with that. But yeah, fine. All right, yeah, I could see that happening. Yeah.
Gareth Southgate cannot quit Jordan Henderson. He just can't. It's not in his being.
All right, so as far as I can see, Graham, the other big issue for England is the full-back position, the left-back position, I should say. Not many of them on as options here. We had Chilwell playing not the finest in these friendlies. You can't read too much into that, I suppose. But Luke Shaw, obviously, is going to be first choice if he's available. Or Kieran Trippier moved over?
Potentially. I mean, the left-back position now all of a sudden looks like a real concern for England. Luke Shaw is out injured, as you say, Ryan. Southgate says he might be back for the Euros, but won't be able to play every match. So let's say England make a run to the final. I hope that doesn't happen. That's seven matches. Luke Shaw's not going to play seven matches. So that leaves Ben Chilwell, who, as you say, really struggled, particularly against Brazil. He's out of form, looked vulnerable defensively, didn't offer a lot going forward, which is not a good combination for a fullback, for a left-back. Joe Gomez replaced him against Brazil, but Joe Gomez is a centre-back by trade, and he plays at left-back like a centre-back by trade. He wants to push into the middle. It's a totally different option on the left side of that defence for England. Some other options, maybe Tino Livramento, I think, would be a good option, but he wasn't in the squad, and that means if he's called in, he'll be making his debut the month of the tournament. So, yeah, it feels like it's become a real pain point for England ahead of the Euros, and Kieran Trippier might end up being the best option in that position. The other bullet point, I said there were three bullet points, that's two of them, Mainoo and in the left-back position. The other bullet point relates to the additions that Ollie Watkins and Ivan Toney had over the two games. Harry Kane is out injured at the moment. I don't think it's a major injury. I think he'll be back pretty soon for Bayern Munich, but wasn't fit enough to play for England.
Yeah, I think there's a Clásico this weekend that they're expecting to be back for. So we'll see.
Well, there we go. He wasn't going to take any chances ahead of that. So this was a chance for the B options to show how they would perform in that role. I don't think Ollie Watkins impressed much against Brazil, and a lot of that was down to England being pretty insipid all round and not giving him a lot to work with. Ivan Toney got the start against Belgium and scored from the penalty spot, but even looking beyond that, because it was a penalty kick after all, he's very good at penalties, that might be a factor at the tournament, but I thought his all-round game was a better fit for the way that England play in the attack, where they need a focal point who does more than just get on the end of through balls and crosses, because Kane is an all-round centre-forward, and so they're used to, almost like the muscle memory, they need someone who does something vaguely relatable to that, and I think Toney probably came out of this window with his stock a little bit higher. I think as long as he can avoid injury, he will probably be on the plane to Germany.
I'd say so. Definitely next best option in that position. Agreed there, Graham. Now, England are favourites to win Euro 2024, it concerns me because I don't feel like that's anywhere near the case looking historically. And
really, you don't think that's anywhere near the case?
I just feel a quarterfinal exit. It feels inevitable.
That's the 90s in you.
Yeah, it is. But that leads me to Germany, who are among the favourites, who should be the favourite. Home tournament, just beat France and the Netherlands. Looks like they're gearing up at the right point here, Graham.
Yeah, so I've got a piece of news that I'm sure will be surprising to nobody. Germany looked to be peaking at the right time for an international tournament.
Yay.
I know, shocking. Yay. They never do that before. The caveat here is that they have played two friendly matches, and that is not always a great gauge of where a team is. And before these two friendly matches, they were very, very bad, which probably speaks to as to why they're third in the betting. Having said that, man, in that France game in particular, Germany were really, really impressive. They also beat the Netherlands 2-1 at home. That France game was away from home. The game against France was a thesis statement on what Nagelsmann wants to do with this Germany team. On paper, you could say it was a 4-2-3-1, but it was a 4-2-2-2-2. I always have to make sure I've got the right number of twos with that formation. It was a 4-2-2. That's what I'm going to call it from now on. A lot of the time in that game, which is obviously Nagelsmann's trademark shape. And while in the past it's felt like he's kind of shoehorned players into this formation, I felt like that at Bayern Munich, there were players who didn't really fit that shape. I think it works really, really well for this group of Germany players. There was intensity in and out of possession. France really struggled to play through under pressure, and you don't see that very often from them. Toni Kroos is out of international retirement. He controlled things in the midfield. I think that could make a big difference at the Euros. The Kroos return, though, is sort of a bit of an exception because Nagelsmann is experimenting with a lot of new, younger options. He called up six players for this camp, players like Pavlovic and Dennis Undav and Mittelstadt at left back. He looks like that might be his position for the Euros. This new generation, though, is fronted by Musiala and Wirtz, who were so good against France. Both so good. Wirtz, by the way, scores the opener after 7 seconds, and it wasn't even the quickest goal of the night because Christoph Baumgartner scores the fastest goal in international football history for Austria on the same night after 6 seconds. But that midfield and attacking unit of Musiala, Wirtz, Gundogan and Havertz, that has everything that Nagelsmann wants from that part of the pitch. And if the other parts of the team hold up, I think there are some concerns over the defence, understandably so. But if those parts of the team hold up, I think Germany are going to be a real force this summer because that front four just looks incredible. I'd be really fearful for whoever they're up against in the opening game. Let me just check who that is. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Oh, dear. That's not going to go well.
Are you going to that one, Graham?
I am, yes.
Yes, very nice.
Have my eyes closed the whole time.
It's Scotland, by the way, listener, just in case that wasn't clear. Germany traditionally struggling with the forward number nine position, Graham. Kai Havertz was doing it for the most part here, and Niklas Füllkrug as well. Do we feel like that has been satiated, that area of the field?
I think so, reasonably so. I mean, it works pretty well in that shape that Nagelsmann has, where he needs the two forward players to almost be split forwards, and Havertz certainly does that. Not so convinced about Füllkrug, but he didn't start the France game. It tended to be Musiala in that more attacking role. Even Gundogan, to be honest, pressing beyond the midfield and pushing up alongside Kai Havertz. So it's certainly modern, but I think it works. It works pretty well. The interchangeability and fluidity between those four players, and then you have the base. With Kroos at the base controlling things, it just worked really well. So I think Nagelsmann has potentially struck upon something there.
All right. And Graham, you mentioned Germany in the top three of the favourites. France, presumably, is second in the betting. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So they had that game against Germany and then a win over Chile. Anything learned from France, do we feel, at this point?
Olivier Giroud is still an important part of that team, even if he moves to LAFC, which seems like it's happening. But yeah, France were just France. I think that performance against Germany was more due to Germany being good than France being bad. It very much felt like the kind of window where France were just more concerned with getting players minutes in their legs rather than putting on a show.
All right, fair enough. How about Spain then, Graham? A 3-3 presumably bonkers draw with Brazil on Tuesday. Yeah. I didn't catch that one, but a loss to Colombia as well. What are we making of Luis De La Fuente's side at this point?
Yeah, it was a mixed window. As you say, a defeat to Colombia in London. I think that game was at the London Stadium.
It was, West Ham Stadium, yeah.
Peculiar. Okay, international window. You do you.
We did have Italy playing both its games in the US as well, Graham, I should say.
And I saw Gabriel Marcotti.
Yeah.
Surprised he didn't know anything about Inter Miami Stadium, but tweeting, "What is this weird modular stadium that Italy are playing in?" Yeah, that's the stadium that Lionel Messi plays in every second week.
And by the way, we mentioned about tests and tune-ups. Two starting 11s were completely different for Italy in both their games. So
That's not uncommon. I think Spain did something similar in their two games. So as I say, a defeat to Colombia, then a 3-3 draw against Brazil in a whirlwind match at the Bernabeu. The Brazil match was arranged in response to the racism faced by Vinicius Jr. He gave an emotional press conference before the game where he talked about the impact of racism and how it's taking its toll on him. Unfortunately, the story that has come out of this game is that Real Madrid claimed there wasn't much cooperation from the Spanish Federation. The idea was that this match would prompt the Federation to set out stricter punishments for people who racially abuse players and for clubs who harbour those players. Nothing like this materialised, so feels like a missed opportunity. I'm not surprised because this seems to be the way things are in Spain. Nothing ever changes and it's depressing. In terms of the game itself, I'm going to talk about the Spain-Brazil game because that's the more interesting of the two. In terms of that game, Luis De La Fuente really rotated his lineup between the two matches. So I don't know if we saw Spain as they will shape up at the Euros. I think the Brazil lineup was a little bit closer to their full strength team. The big individual story out of this window for Spain was Lamine Yamal, who could be as important to the national team as he is to Barcelona. He was brilliant against Brazil, so brilliant that he got a standing ovation from the crowd, obviously the game taking place at the Bernabeu. The only other players I can remember that happening to are Messi and Ronaldinho. The significance there, of course, being that they're Barcelona players playing at the home of Real Madrid. That doesn't happen very often. He had 63 touches of the ball, which was among the highest number of touches by any player, despite the fact he's an attacking player. He won a penalty. He got an assist. He completed more dribbles and won more ground duels than any other player on the pitch. He is a real difference maker for Spain in a way that moves the needle for them, or could move the needle for them at the Euros. The issue under Lucho was that while they controlled games, they didn't have someone who was willing to take a risk or make something happen in the final third. And now they have that player in Lamine Yamal. The other big success story from the window for Spain was Dani Olmo as the number 10. So Gavi is still out injured. So De La Fuente has had to rethink his midfield a little bit, and it seems like he's leaning towards using Olmo through the middle rather than out wide, which is where he's largely played for Spain up until now. He scored a beauty of a goal against Brazil, where he nutmegs a player and then beats another player and then bends a finish into the far corner. It's all done in such tight space. I don't think the Brazilian defender knew what had hit him. And I think the most exciting thing for Spain was that Olmo was really effective at conducting attacks for them, with Yamal on one side and then Nico Williams on the other. There was good balance. Nico stretches the pitch with his pace on one side. Yamal comes inside. Olmo drops deep and makes late runs himself and ties it all together. So that trio in behind Morata as the focal point gives Spain a very different feel as a team. Obviously, they still have that control from the Lucho era, but there's just so much more thrust to their play. It's not just possession for possession's sake. And if they can carry that into the Euros, I think they will be a real force.
Wow. Okay. If we could just touch on Brazil a little bit as well, Graham. Obviously, you mentioned a few friendlies they've had in Europe over the past week or so. That one at Wembley against England, which it wasn't exactly Hugo Benito, from what I could see, that was happening on the field there. But they're also playing against Spain at the Bernabeu, as you mentioned there, with Endrick.
Certainly
looked very good at Wembley. He's going to be calling the Bernabeu home from July onwards as well. He looks good.
Yes, he does. This window was really the first glimpse a lot of fans will have had of Endrick. I have written about him before, so I've seen more of them than is normal, but I can't recall having watched them in a full match before. So even for myself, this is the first time me getting, well, I didn't start either two games, but like getting a sustained 30 minute view of him. So he is the 17-year-old prodigy who's joining Real Madrid this summer. He scored the winner for Brazil against England at Wembley, then scores an excellent goal off the bench against Spain, as you say, Ryan, in the stadium he'll be playing his club soccer next season. This kid looks like a Pele regen. Shirt tucked in, a sort of like stockiness to him, and just so immensely talented. And also with the courage to, the same thing I was saying about Kobe Mainoo, just the courage to go into a team full of superstars, playing a team full of superstars in one of the biggest stadiums in the world, and the ability to just show what you're all about on such a big stage. He's going to be a superstar, and he's going to get more and more of an opportunity, I think, to show it for Brazil. Brazil are in this weird position as a team right now. So they spent the last year, we've spoken about this on the show a number of times, they spent the last year waiting for Carlo Ancelotti to take over, and now that's not going to happen. He's signed a new contract at Real Madrid. So Fernando Diniz was in charge for a period. Now Dorival Jr. has been given the job permanently, and he is someone who has coached basically every domestic team in Brazil. Go and look at his Wikipedia page. It's basically just a list of every Brazilian team there is, but there is still a sense that if a big name became available, Brazil would jump at them, especially if the Copa America doesn't go so well, which until this window was a distinct possibility given their recent qualifying form, where they've gone four games, without a win. I thought both performances against England and Spain were really positive. Against England, we saw some moments of control through midfield, but also some counter-attacking moments, a lot of defensive discipline. It felt like a really good tournament performance, if I was to be kind about that sort of display. Then against Spain, we saw Dorival take the handbrake off. That front six of Vinicius, Rodrigo, Rafinha, your boy Ryan, Lucas Paqueta, Bruno Guimarães and João Gomes, I think that has real potential. Then, of course, you have Endrick coming off the bench and replacing Rafinha. That was the unit that Brazil started with in both matches, and then Endrick came on. Defensively, it wasn't so positive. Lucas Beraldo really struggled. He was the one that was put in a spin by Dani Olmo for his goal. Also conceded a penalty that led to Spain's third. Fabrício Bruno was the other centre-back. He didn't fare much better, but I wouldn't be too worried about that if I was Brazil, because they do have the likes of Marquinhos and Gabriel and Eder Militao all to come back. So their defensive line will likely look much different this summer at the Copa America.
Yeah, and just to go back to Endrick, A, cool name. B, yeah. He was born in July 2006. He was born after the 2006 World Cup final, Graham.
That makes me sick.
Yeah, disgusting behaviour. Absolutely disgusting. Yeah, but Brazil looking pretty strong at the moment, all things considered. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to let Graham sort of go and do his press-ups and sort of get psyched up to talk about Scotland after the break. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our international break roundup. Scotland, Graham, they're going to the Euros. Big loss to the Netherlands, but not a bad performance by all accounts in that 4-0 loss to the Netherlands. And then another loss to Northern Ireland at Hampden Park, which I believe you were privy to watching with your very own eyes.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So we have a Scotland team which is winless in 7 games going into this tournament. Friendlies with Gibraltar and Finland, the mighty thereof, coming just before the Euros. But how are you feeling about the path to the tournament, Graham?
So you said before we went to break that I was away to do my push-ups, my press-ups. What I actually did was the Ewan McGregor train spotting routine. Sat on a rock in the countryside. And
you dived into a toilet, sorry.
Yeah, I'll do that later. No, I sat on a rock in the countryside and said, it's rubbish to be Scotland, censoring a certain Scottish, censoring a word there. Yeah, I didn't have a great time at Hampden on Tuesday night watching Scotland lose 1-0 to Northern Ireland. It was honestly the worst I've seen Scotland play in a long time, which I guess is a weird positive, because these sort of performances, this is what I watched for 20 years, and now thankfully they're not so common. But yeah, I'd rather we were heading into the Euros in better form. As you mentioned, Ryan, we lost 4-0 to the Netherlands last Friday, but that was a weird, weird scoreline. Scotland actually played really well, and you had Virgil van Dijk and Ronald Koeman coming out afterwards and saying that Scotland had been the better team, certainly for 70 minutes. We didn't take our chances. The XG was up until the 70-minute mark, where for the final 20 minutes of the match, both teams made loads of changes, and I think that kind of warped things a little bit, and the Netherlands scored a couple goals in that time. But for 70 minutes, you had the strongest Netherlands team and you had the strongest Scotland team, and Scotland in Amsterdam were genuinely, they looked like the stronger team. So that's a weird game. I'm not entirely sure what happened there.
It was weird, Graham, seeing Ronald Koeman after the game basically criticising his team massively after a 4-0 win. You don't see that very often.
Well, the Dutch press, the newspaper front pages the next day were all critical of the way that the Netherlands played. I think that's largely because the Dutch being the Dutch, they expect more than results, right? They expect their team to play total football, like Johan Cruyff football. And Scotland came to Amsterdam and held their own in possession sense and potentially even looked better on the ball than the Netherlands. So I think that's part of it. But yeah, it was a weird game. I said to you in the Slack, I came out of that game strangely more confident than when I went in, which is weird when your team loses 4-0. But anyway, let's push that one to the side. The Northern Ireland game...
But you're not as confident after the second game.
No, not at all. The Northern Ireland game was much, much more concerning because there were no chances at all. Loads of the ball, but so many lateral passes. No risk-taking at all. It was so unbelievably lethargic. And it feels like the feel-good sense that was around the Scotland team last year, it's kind of gone. So that's great heading into the Euros, and our new kits are rubbish as well. So that just caps it.
Well, that might have been part of it, right? Northern Ireland saw the opportunity with the bad kits and took advantage.
What if these kits are cursed, Ryan? What if Adidas have given us cursed kits for the Euros?
Do you think that's possible?
I mean, if you want me to break down the logic of that, I think my argument might fall apart.
But. All right. Okay. Remind us, Graham, which games you're going to see at the Euros, and you're seeing Scotland at least a couple of times, am I right?
Yeah, so I've got tickets to all three Scotland group games. So that's Scotland-Germany, the opening match, then Scotland-Switzerland, and then Scotland-Hungary. And then I've got three other tickets for games. So I've got a Spain-Italy ticket, I've got a France-Poland ticket, and I've got a Slovakia-Romania ticket. So six games in total.
Amazing. Of course, Graham will be reporting from the front lines on Total Soccer Show. We'll be covering the tournament in full on this feed. We won't be covering the mighty San Marino during that period, Graham. They're not at this tournament. Can we talk a little bit about them? They're slightly the butt of jokes in European soccer. San Marino, by the way, a landlocked, what do you call it? A microstate within Italy. I don't know why it's not part of Italy. There's political reasons dating back many years, but it's basically 20 square miles within Italy. I've actually been there. I've got my passport stamped there. It's a lot of fun.
Do you think they're just a group of people like you, Ryan, who didn't like Italy?
Yeah.
And they were like, we're just going to create our own country.
You know, 20 square miles, but there's a Starbucks in every corner, Graham. It's wonderful. So basically, the thing about San Marino is they're all part-timers, not very good. They haven't won a game for 20 years. Their last win was in 2004, a 1-0 win over Liechtenstein. The rationale with many San Marino fans and analysts was that they only play European sides who tend to be a lot stronger than them. So they thought, let's branch out. Let's do something different. They played St. Kitts and Nevis during this break, Graham. How did it go?
Not well for San Marino. They drew the first game, they lost the first game 3-1 and then drew the second one 0-0. So that's 138 games without a win, which frankly feels about as long as Scotland's winless run right now, but I think the numbers show that it is a little bit longer. They play Slovakia in June. 139th time, lucky, perhaps?
Yeah, don't think so.
The weird thing about this game was, so in the UK, this was picked up by Viaplay, who are very much like the network of international football in the UK, unless you're watching an England game. And so the number of people on my Twitter timeline who were booking this game, particularly the second one, because I think the first one caught people by surprise. They maybe didn't know the story around it or why San Marino were playing St. Kitts and Nevis. But by the second game on the Sunday night, there was nothing else on as well, which is the other thing. The number of people that seemed to be watching this San Marino game was absolutely incredible.
Did you catch it?
No, I didn't. I decided that I had better things to do.
Fair enough. All right, well, yeah, San Marino's quest for a win does continue. I don't know if you listened to the Peter Crouch podcast, Graham, but you where he calls his wife, Abby Clancy, San Marino. Do you know why he calls her San Marino on the podcast?
Enlighten me.
This is a quote from him. I'm not going to give any opinion on this. He says, because San Marino kicks off every 10 minutes.
Oh, jeez. All right.
Yeah. That's what they're dealing with over on the Peter Crouch podcast feed. Yeah.
I take it Abby Clancy doesn't listen to that podcast.
I actually saw or listened to one where she was on it and they explained it and she went, oh, I thought San Marino was a person. And I think she confused him with Mourinho. Excellent. Good stuff. Graham, we saw the Basque national team in action in this break as well. This is something that's been going for quite a while, the Basque national team. Obviously, the Basque region is a region in Spain who have long sought autonomy and have autonomy, of course, of sorts. But they are trying to get an international team sort of ratified with FIFA. Looks like they're pushing towards that path. I think there's been friendlies in the past between the Basque team and the Catalan team as well, for example, if memory serves. But yeah, that's an interesting one because obviously when they play, they have to play in the same windows when the Spanish national team is playing, which limits selection, I guess.
Yeah, so the Basque country, they played a friendly against Uruguay in this window, which obviously saw Marcelo Bielsa, who's the Uruguay manager, return to Bilbao, where he's still an icon for the Athletic fans. Of course, he was manager of an Athletic club for, I think, a couple seasons, maybe two or three seasons. Remember that great Athletic team that beat Manchester United in the Europa League and it had Iker Muniain in it. I think that was Bielsa's team. But anyway, he's a real icon for those fans. The Basque country can put out a serious team. It's basically an Athletic club / Real Sociedad hybrid.
Yeah.
I sort of wonder how they would get on in major tournaments. So Alvaro Diallo, who plays for Braga in Portugal, he scores the goal for the Basque country. It was a 1-1 draw in that game. But you look through some of the names. I mean, yes, it's very heavily La Real and Athletic Club, but Aitor Fernandez plays for Osasuna. You've got Aritz Elizondo, plays for Real Sociedad, of course. Danny Garcia. As I said, Alvaro Diallo, Roberto Torres. So like there is experience and quality in that squad. I wrote about the Basque country for my newsletter, I think at some point last year. At that point, the stance from FIFA and UEFA was just no chance because they fall down on a number of the criteria. I think some of it's like governance. They don't have full control of over, you know, tax and political stuff. A lot of it is controlled by Madrid. So I don't know if they would ever get a FIFA or UEFA membership until that changes. But yeah, in terms of the team on the pitch, it's fairly impressive. And then it gets your mind thinking about, well, what other teams from other regions that don't have a national team would be able, like, what would a California national team look like? Off the top of my head, I can't think how many of the USMNT are from California, but I bet that would be pretty strong as well.
I mean, yeah, biggest state in the union, you'd imagine proportionally it would do okay. Oh, yeah, I have to think about that one. But yeah, obviously, the Basque region is helped by the Cantera policy, which Athletic Bilbao still has, where they only pick Basque players for their team. And I think Sociedad and a few of the others have had those policies, but they relaxed them over the years. But Bilbao, Athletic Club, sorry, very much still have it in place. So that very much helps feed any potential... Do we call it a national team? A region team? I don't know what we call
them. Yeah, I call it a national team. My newsletter this week, by the way, is about Vatican City, who apparently UEFA and FIFA both say, in you come, because they have... like complete political autonomy. So they would, a country of 800 people would apparently get admitted to FIFA and UEFA before the Basque country, which is kind of wild.
I'm quite familiar with the Vatican City, having lived quite near it for a few years. Where are those 800 people living? That's what I want to know. Like, are they in like a, I don't know, in one of the...
Just in the Pope's spare rooms.
Yeah.
There's 800
how many
people
staff
who live
does
in
he
there.
Have? Are they all his staff? That's what I want to know. Anyway, that will be fine if that one comes to fruition as well. All right, Graham, it's time to round up any other storylines we saw. What else have you seen over this international break you want to talk about?
Yeah, so just some quick hits here. So Anguilla, who are the world's 208th best national team, ahead of only San Marino, so they're the second worst team in the world, and had not won a match since 2010. Well, they beat Turks and Caicos Islands on penalties to reach the second round of CONCACAF World Cup qualification for the first time. So that'll just deepen the malaise in San Marino. They're big rivals on the other side of the world who were winless since 2010. They ended their winless run in this window, and San Marino didn't. I mentioned Austria earlier, but just to labour the point, they scored the quickest goal in international history in a win over Slovakia, and then they smashed Turkey 6-1.
What did that goal look like, matches. Graham? I didn't catch that one.
It was basically just Baumgartner from centre setting off on a run and then just finishing. It took him 6 seconds to get from the halfway line to basically, I think, just inside the box, and then he finished it off. It was almost like Slovakia didn't hear the whistle. They were not set at all, and Baumgartner... took advantage of that.
Nice.
But Austria, they are in good shape. They've won 5 matches in a row. As I said, haven't lost since October 2022. I think they could be a real threat at the Euros. Ranić's doing a very good job. They are in a group with France, Netherlands, and Poland, which is looking like the most competitive group at that tournament. No World Cup qualifying in CAF in this window, but Nigeria beat Ghana in Ghana for the first time ever, so some history made there. Ivory Coast won their first match since winning AFCON by beating Uruguay. Uruguay on their travels in this window, playing the Basque country and then Ivory Coast. Morocco beat Angola 1-0 and then drew 0-0 with Mauritania. But the real headline for them was the debut of Brahim Diaz, who has decided to play for Morocco over Spain. And given his recent form for Real Madrid, that is a big deal. And that's the kind of player that could really move the needle for them if we cast our mind back to AFCON and some of the things we were saying about them at that tournament. Very strong structurally, but maybe lack a player to take a chance or make something happen in the final third. I think the hope is that Brahim Diaz will be that player. And then finally, as you mentioned, Ryan, the last thing on my list was the Basque country, which I very, very much enjoyed that game. I hope we get to see more of the Basque country. I'd like a Scotland friendly against the Basque country. I think we'd probably lose that game at the moment. But yeah, make it happen.
Oh, there you go. There's some similarities there, both in the northern parts of the country. That's where the similarities end, as far as I can tell. Yeah.
I think Eibar is like a Basque club, isn't it? They're in the Basque country. They sing like Scottish songs, and their fans hold up Scottish saltire flags. So there's some kind of affinity there. Maybe we'll play Eibar. We'll play the Basque country at Eibar Stadium.
Presumably that has like a shipping history of some sort, I would imagine.
Do you know what, Ryan? I've written about this in the past. There'll be a Scotsman article about this from me, and I've completely forgotten what the story is. But there is some sort of connection.
I was just thinking, because like in Bilbao, it's the Ports, and it was like Sunderland / Southampton fans from the Ports in Sunderland and Southampton who came over and gave them their kits.
It's probably just rain. Yeah. Rain's the connection.
Maybe that. Graham,
it's us, the Basque country, and Portland. That's the trio.
There you go. The Rain Trio. Excellent stuff. One last thing, Graham. If people want to read, say, a weekly newsletter to learn about these sort of lesser fixtures and storylines they may not have heard about, where can they go?
So that is, you'd find that in my newsletter called The Soccer Dispatch. So that is thesoccerdispatch.substack.com. Easy for me to say. At the moment, we are doing a prize draw, or I'm doing a prize draw for a Euro 2024 replica shirt of your choice. So you don't need to be a paid subscriber. You can subscribe for free, enter that draw. I'll be drawing that at some point over the weekend. And you've got a pretty good chance of winning as far as these things go. You're up against like some like hundreds of other people, but normally these things are like thousands. So yeah, that's where you'll find my newsletter.
Excellent. I'm going to pick a Scotland kit just to rile you up on that one, if that's okay.
Not an England kit? I'm really hoping someone doesn't win it and then ask me to buy an England kit.
Okay, but you'll find out. You'll find out in good course. Yeah, thank you very much for that, Graham. And patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you'd like to continue supporting Total Soccer Show. Thank you very much to everyone who has done so. There's bonus episodes, bonus videos, and access to our Discord where all the cool kids are hanging out. Graham, international window. Check. Done. Review.
And there's not another one until the Euros, so you must be delighted about that, Ryan Bailey.
Yay! Fun times ahead. All right. Thank you very much, Graham, for all your contributions to this and your continual watching of every game possible.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
And listener, thank you very much for joining us on this one. We appreciate you once again. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you'd like to support us. We'll be back on this feed very shortly indeed. But for now, bye!